Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean, and you are on the show called Getting It Done. I started not to do the show because I'm away from both for Florida and South Carolina. However, I decided there's a whole lot that I would like to talk to my audience about, and why wait until another time when you may not have the time to do it. So, looking at the future, let's look at the past first while looking at what we call present and future. In order to do this, we will be listening to the life of a genius who made things possible for us to experience today. Now, this was back in 1987. I was working on my postdoctoral degree at the University of, Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. And one of the projects I had was given to me to do was to, well, everybody in that group were working on different kinds of degrees, but this was a institute that promoted science. So the instructor asked us all to pick out one of the greatest scientists that we thought of and write about that individual in terms of what they accomplished and how great they were and basically what made them to be great and how they affected society as a whole. I chose Dr. George Washington Carver. I don't even know why I chose him. I mean, he's black, but there are other black scientists I could have chosen. But I chose him and wrote more than a meaningful amount of research that I did on him as a individual and a person who accomplished much. And I took it to the professor, handed it on time, which sometimes I'm not always on time. But in this case, I surprised myself and I just couldn't understand why I was so motivated to do George Washington Carver. But what blew my mind completely after this, listening to this college professor who was my teacher saying to me that Dr. George Washington Carver was not a scientist, but an inventor. And I looked at him and I wanted to laugh in his face, but out of respect, I didn't do it. And he said, "Well, you know, you can leave this in it, or you can write me about somebody else. And, you know, we'll see about a different grade for you." But if you want to, because you already have a doctorate, I could give you a gentleman's grade. I didn't want to get in any big old argument with the man. I had a lot of respect for him, but it was completely diminished when I found out that here's this white man who was in the field of science, didn't know that George Washington Carver was a scientist. As a matter of fact, George Washington Carver and my former minister worked very closely together at Tuskegee Institute down in Alabama or Tennessee, or one of those places down south. But the more importantly, my pastor was I consider him to be a genius also, Reverend Jonathan Reed. Jonathan Reed was taught chemistry and all kinds of maths. So, but he was called home by his father to take over the church, but constantly had communications with Booker T. Washington and Dr. George Washington Carver. They were friends. So, but I didn't understand why this man, who was a college professor, did not know that George Washington Carver was a scientist. In fact, he was a lot of other things besides just being a scientist. But that's either here or there. We're going to try to do a little listening of him today And then we're going to go on and listen to some masters of inventions, those who were inventors, so we can see the difference between a scientist and an inventor.
And a love of life.
He was more than just a scientist. He was an artist. He was an educator. He was a humanitarian. And he did so much to help others.
Scientist, professor, a leader, a man of faith. He was a conservationist.
He was very creative. He had a childlike wonderment about life.
He loved humanity in the beginning. He loved black and white. George Washington Carver was a man of hope.
Carver's rise from slavery to scientific accomplishment has inspired people worldwide. Even today, children study the story of Carver, and lists of prominent African Americans always contain his name. Yet time has dulled the luster of his reputation, reducing him to the man who did something with peanuts. George Washington Carver was a complex man who had many gifts. In 1941, Time magazine dubbed him the Black Leonardo. George Washington Carver was an artist. He was a scientist. He was a geologist. He was a poet. He was a Bible scholar. That's a Renaissance man.
George Washington Carver was a creative genius who was able to evoke personal and shared identities to protect him from the very genesis of enslavement, discrimination, and who took those negative experiences and translated them into the universe of humanity that is extraordinary, locally, nationally, and internationally.
Following Carver's death in 1943, the nation rushed to memorialize him. Congress made his birthplace a national monument. Postage stamps and coins were issued with his likeness, and naval vessels and scores of public buildings were named in his honor.
He was a man of concern, a man of vision, a man who actually wanted to make a difference. And the difference wasn't necessarily for him. It was a difference for other people.
Born into slavery in the final months of the Civil War, George Washington Carver rose to become one of the best known and widely respected African Americans in the world. Henry Ford called him the world's greatest living scientist. Presidents and poor black farmers alike praised him. Mahatma Gandhi's assistant asked him for advice in creating a vegetarian diet for the Indian activists. Groups as different as the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the United Daughters of the Confederacy honored him.
He's a usable hero for Americans, and I think that's a disservice to Carver. I think he is important for a lot of reasons other than that.
In reality, Carver was a complicated man. Thousands of people around the world held warm affection for him and regarded him as a personal friend. Yet Carver never married, lived alone in a dormitory room most of his adult life, seldom socialized, and worked by himself in his laboratory. He was known for his humility and simplicity, wearing a tattered suit adorned by a single flower in his lapel. He devoted his life to helping African-American farmers suffering the oppression of racism, poverty, and ignorance.
He used to quote this little poem called "It's Service That Measures Success." And that, the gist of it was, it isn't the price of the clothes that you're wearing or the number of servants who come at your call. It's service that measures success. He stated things simply and beautifully. And that's one thing that I think makes him so relevant, is that he's accessible.
George Washington Carver's long journey to worldwide fame began in obscure circumstances. He was born around 1864 on an isolated Missouri farm owned by Moses Carver. Both of his parents were slaves. His father was crushed under the wheels of a lumber cart around the time of George's birth. Before George was a year old, he and his mother Mary were abducted by lawless raiders and taken to Arkansas, where they could be resold. Moses Carver dispatched a Union Army scout to find and return them. The man somehow found George desperately ill with whooping cough, but Mary was never seen again. Moses and Susan Carver took George and his older half-brother Jim into their home and raised them as their own. Orphaned, sickly, and newly freed from slavery, George's prospects were dim. From an early age, however, he was drawn to nature, seen as special. He was unusually talented at almost everything he tried to do, and he had a raging curiosity to learn everything he could.
He spoke about the time that he would have out in nature and just enjoying the solace, the tranquility, and speaking to the Creator, what he did. And then he took that throughout his lifetime. But throughout his life, he then had this this love of nature, which then went into the plant life and went into how he could take plants and break them down chemically and create other products, all for the benefit of helping people.
He had what could be called visions. He said, as a very small boy exploring the almost virgin woods of the old Carver place, I had the impression that someone had just been there ahead of me. Things were so orderly, so clean, so harmoniously beautiful. A few years later in this same woods, I was to understand the meaning of this boyish impression because I was practically overwhelmed with a sense of some great presence. Not only had someone been there, someone was there. I knew even then that it was the great spirit of the universe. Never since have I been without this consciousness of God speaking to me through plants, rocks, and every other aspect of his creation.
Being here, being in the wood area when he had free time, where he would learn about how flowers would grow, how trees would grow, and was very curious and would explore and would ask a lot of questions from what I understand. And he became known as the plant doctor when he was in the woods here. And I really do believe it influenced him quite a bit.
Because George was often sick and frail, his brother Jim helped Moses on the farm. George helped Susan with household chores, where he learned to sew, cook, and do laundry and needlework. Moses' influence was seen in George's relentless work ethic, love of music, and his disdain for wastefulness.
The paradox is that this young African-American kid grew up in a household dominated by two rather elderly white people. And for a time, he had his brother Jim with him. But beyond his brother Jim, there's no evidence that Carver had much contact with other African Americans. And to me, that's a very important reality of his life. So he's born in a state that is in great conflict. The conflict ends, but the animosities don't. And he's born into a state that is segregated when it came to education. African Americans and whites went to separate schools. And that would have, I think, a tremendous effect on Carver. There are multiple instances in Carver's life in which he refers to himself variously as the orphan child of a despised race. And that's always been a very telling phrase for me. I think in that regard, Carver had a lot of tremendous insecurities. Why wouldn't he?
The Carvers did their best to provide George with some education, but by the time he was around 12 years old, his curiosity could no longer be contained. There was a school for blacks in Neosho, a town 8 miles away. George set out alone and on foot to achieve an education.
It represents powerful psychological resiliency. What motivates a young person, 10, 12 years old, to leave where he resides and walk 8 miles to a school? It is not only the site from which he originated his education, it's a site that actually represents the initiation of what I call his path to freedom. And that's the anchor, that's the beginning of the incredible story that's called Carver.
When George arrived in Neosho, Andrew and Mariah Watkins, a childless black couple, agreed to take him in as long as he was willing to help with the chores. Even though George lived with the Watkins only a short period of time, Mariah seemed to have made a powerful impression on him. She was a midwife in the community and had a great knowledge of plants and their medicinal powers, which appealed to George and inspired his lifelong conviction illnesses could be cured through the proper use of plants and the products extracted from them. Mariah's strong faith also influenced George, and she was the first person he met who urged him to use his genius to serve their people.
What I term deeply forged spirituality, which does not mean the same thing as religion, and which I'm arguing that a deeply forged spirituality requires one to wear it, be cognizant of it, be in contact with it in all one's interactions. And I think one of the reasons he was such an extraordinary humanitarian is that it derived from what I just spoke to.
George loved people, and he dedicated his life to improving humanity's lot. He once wrote, "I love humanity and all humanity who is struggling to be something and somebody. I am not interested in complexion, texture of hair, nationality, etc. I like all of God's work. So may we continue to pray and to love each other more and more, if possible, as time moves on."
That's what Jesus Christ did. He came to serve others. And that's where I feel the call that I think is the influence of the impact, the influence of his life, like that of Christ, influenced a lot of other people in a very positive way.
Dreams were real to him. Dreams he perceived to be God's way of talking to him. And in that regard, I think he thought he was special, that he was imbued with qualities that were God-given. And I think that was a source of great strength for him and a source of confidence.
Well, he said God gives everybody a talent. And God gave George Washington Carver a talent for science without compromising faith, religion, or God. And I think that's what motivated him. He was born with his mission, even though he's a little boy. He probably didn't know when he was 5 years of age that he was going to be a great scientist and a great humanitarian, but God instilled that in him at birth.
Okay. No, Mr. Carver?
George's teacher, Neosho, was unable to give him the level of education that he desired. So when a couple stopped at the Watkins home on their way to Fort Scott, Kansas, he hitched a ride. He made friends, many of them white, but he was never far from the shadow of racism. In Fort Scott, he witnessed the lynching of a black man and left town immediately. Later, he was admitted to Highland College in Kansas, only to be turned away when officials saw the color of his skin.
Those kinds of things could drive you into, you know, a cave. You could just, like, back up and say, I just can't face this, but he didn't. He just kept driving forward and facing the harsh realities ahead. And it's so interesting because towards the end of his life, when he was hired to be a spokesman for interracial cooperation, and what an impact he made on so many people that went on to impact others and impact others. And all those experiences he had, the encounters and the racial barriers, struggles, prejudice, and yet keeping one foot going in front of the other.
One thing that I can appreciate from Carver is that, as an African-American, is that all the things that Carver went through, leaving here and experiencing hate, and he did experience hate, but Carver was never bitter. And that's something that I definitely can appreciate, even in our society today, which some things that Carver went through are still very relevant today as well. And sometimes I look on Carver's life story as an example of how I can be a better person as well.
He didn't take the tragedies of life, the disappointments of life, to define him. And he had things happening so much, you know, so many things, that you're like, how in the world did he even ever want to do anything, much less do something? You know, why would he want to help somebody else if he wasn't getting some of the things that he thought he should have?
Hearing that Iowa might have a college that would accept him, George went there in 1888, landing in the town of Winterset, where he found work at a hotel. Visiting a local church there, he met a white couple named John and Helen Milholland. They treated him like family. Years later, he would say, "Mr. and Mrs. Milholland have been my warmest and most helpful friends."
They did not know that he was going to grow to become this famous scientist or this famous educator. They just saw that he was a person who had worth. They saw a person who had potential. And they took the time to learn about him as an individual, and they took the time to see what they could do to encourage that potential. Though we all can't be like Carver, because I believe he had a real genius, we could all be like the kind of people who encouraged him and inspired him in his way. Just regular everyday people doing what they could to learn about a fellow human being.
Helen Milholland encouraged George to apply to Simpson College, a small Methodist school 20 miles away in Indianola, Iowa. He was accepted and enrolled on September 9th, 1890.
Carver came here and presented his credentials, and the president, President Holmes at that time, said, "Well, of course you're welcome here," and admitted him, and thus began his career at Simpson College.
Years later, George acknowledged the warmth of his reception at Simpson College, simply saying, "They made me believe I was a real human being."
He really found a home there. There's a well-known story about how several of his fellow classmates would invite him to go to concerts, and he couldn't go because he didn't have any money. And before long, after this was known, he would return home to find concert tickets slipped underneath his door.
It was not botany or chemistry that George yearned to study at Simpson. He wanted to be an artist, a painter, and capture the beauty of nature. So it was that he asked Etta Budd, the college's art teacher, for admission to her class, and she gave him the chance.
It's kind of interesting in that she was new to Simpson College the same year that he came, and she was a first-year faculty member in art, and he had been drawing and wanted to pursue his art, and met with her, and she was reluctant actually to let him in her art studio because he didn't present a portfolio or any of the usual reviews that would give her an indication of his talent. Nonetheless, he persisted. He was an impressive fellow, and he flourished. And she encouraged him, and as he grew as an artist, she helped encourage him become better and more adept. But she was concerned that he would actually be able to make a living doing that, but, and realized that he had a great interest in agriculture, agronomy, and botany. and because of that encouraged him to go up to Iowa State and enter the agricultural program, then, which of course he did.
In 1891, George transferred to the Iowa Agricultural College and Model Farm, now Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa, where Etta Budd's father taught horticulture. He remained at Iowa State for 5 years as its first African-American student, earning a master's degree and becoming the first African-American faculty member.
I think it was a powerful validation of his worth as seen by others. My view is that at that point, Carver was thereafter in charge of his own career and life.
At first, life for George at his new school wasn't easy.
He wasn't given a room near the other students. He wasn't allowed to eat with the other students. His professor, Pamel, gave him one of his laboratories to live in. And a white lady from Indianola, a friend named Mrs. Sophia Liston, she came to visit Carver in Ames. She decided she was going to walk around with Carver all around town so that people could see that he was accepted and known in society. And she insisted that she would eat wherever he ate. And so whereas before he had to eat with the higher hands of the workers, the powers that be decided he could eat with the other students. I'm very proud of the fact that Carver decided to stick it out when he first got to Ames. I'm also proud of the fact that the people who perhaps weren't as welcoming of him when he first got there, they were able to learn, they were able to grow, they were able to change.
Eventually, he was embraced by white students and faculty members alike, who saw in him a spark of genius.
I think that legacy is a message to all of us today and into the future, how important it is to value diversity, to give all individuals who choose to work hard, no question that George Washington Carver worked hard every day, a chance to excel and to reach their full potential.
In Ames, George befriended James Wilson, head of the agricultural school, who would serve as U.S. Secretary of Agriculture for 16 years. His dairying professor, Henry C. Wallace, would hold the same post in the 1920s. And Wallace's son, Henry A. Wallace, who frequently accompanied George on nature walks, would serve as agriculture secretary and vice president under Franklin D. Roosevelt.
On Sundays, George Washington Carver would be invited over to the Wallace home for dinner, and afterwards, George Washington Carver and Henry A. Wallace would go for walks, and they would study nature, look at plants, talk about what George Washington Carver was studying at Iowa State University. And interestingly so, George Washington Carver's undergraduate thesis was on plant hybridization. And here he was talking to Henry A. Wallace, who had found Pioneer Hybrid, based on plant hybridization.
George planned to obtain a doctorate at Iowa State, and the school wanted very much to keep him on its faculty in what could have been a contented life of academic distinction. Then, in 1896, a letter arrived that would change everything. "I cannot offer you money, position, or fame," it said. "The first two you have. The last, from the place you now occupy, you will no doubt achieve. These things I now ask you to give up. I offer you in their place work, hard, hard work, the task of bringing a people from degradation, poverty, and waste to full manhood." It was signed by Booker T. Washington, the principal of an industrial and teacher training institute for black students in Tuskegee, Alabama.
We talk about the Tuskegee experience around here, and everyone talks about it, but no one can just come out and explain exactly what it is. We all know that there is something about that Tuskegee experience that keeps you here and keeps you with a desire to want to do more. It may be the grounds of Booker T. Washington. It may be George Washington Carver. because those were two great men who walked the grounds of Tuskegee. And so it's an honor and a privilege, actually, to come behind them and do something substantial for the university.
Booker T. Washington was determined to make Tuskegee a leading educational institution in the South, and his most pressing need was to establish an agriculture department. But to establish such a department, Washington recognized that he needed a black man with an advanced degree in agriculture, and in all the country, there was only one such man, George Washington Carver. To lure Carver to Tuskegee, Washington offered him an annual salary of $1,000 plus living quarters. Despite Washington's warning of hard work, Carver replied to him, "It has always been one ideal of my life to be the greatest good to the greatest number of my people possible. And to this end, I have been preparing myself for these many years, feeling as I do that this line of education is the key to unlock the golden door of freedom to our people." He would remain there until his death 47 years later.
Booker T. and Carver believed that people needed to be taught not only how to live, but to live beautifully, you know, and live well, and to make beautiful things out of everything that was functional. So I think that's important, that kind of contribution to learning that they gave. And that legacy is what made a whole two or three generations back feel that they could do anything. We had these brilliant doctors, brilliant scholars up on campus because they had a place to be geniuses, to show their genius in this little cocoon, some like little protective sphere. And it started with Booker T. and his school. You know, he made a place, a space for people to excel. Carver was part of that.
Carver had never been in the Deep South. Almost everything about Alabama's system of agriculture, with its heavy reliance on cotton and its system of tenant farming called sharecropping, appalled him.
When he first came on the train here to Tuskegee, he talked about seeing all the poor sharecroppers' homes and thinking, wow, they could do better, and he knew that he could help them do better. And he spent pretty much that whole career here doing work that was going to influence and help those local farmers improve the quality of their lives.
In addition to being administrator of the agriculture department and two experimental farms, Washington expected Carver to teach a full load of classes, serve on the Institute's executive committee, oversee the beautification of the campus, serve temporarily as its veterinarian, and establish an outreach program for poor black farmers in the surrounding area.
Washington had one vision for Carver, and Carver had another vision for himself. It was tumultuous at times, but I think, and I know, that they both had mutual respect for each other.
Carver began his teaching in an old shack with no facilities. In order to establish some sort of laboratory, he had to root through junk heaps to find usable bottles and other items.
Why in the heck did he come to Tuskegee? Where he came, where people were jealous of him, clearly the resources he obtained were less, came to a hostile environment, both politically, socially, despite all that. Why did he come? You know, and you look and read the history, and it comes down to serve my people. That is the most fundamental piece that I want to share from my vantage point of 40 years in here, because taking on that task, that's the most daunting task. Just a few years out from slavery ending, decade or so after enslavement, right into the heart of the beast. Now, the only way you could do this is you have to be a warrior. You have to have courage. You have to be tough. You have to be so mission-oriented. You had to suffer the indignities that a black person had to suffer during that time, and yet he continued on his journey. That's the real power. That's the real spirit within.
I think after a while you can get very frustrated and go do something else. But he didn't. And that's, I think, his own core of what he never wavered from what his own commitment was in the very beginning.
When Carver arrived in the South, there were roughly 5 million black farmers there. Only about one-fifth of them owned any land. Almost all of them shared a common problem. Over-reliance on cotton as the region's main cash crop, together with the sharecropper system used to produce it, which depleted the soil and kept tenant farmers in a permanent state of impoverishment, improving the practice of southern agriculture and the lot of poor farmers became Carver's chief concern.
I think that Carver quickly recognized whatever preconceptions he had about the South when he went down there, he quickly recognized the enormity of the challenges he faced. And so I think he concluded very quickly that he had to come up with some practical ways that would improve the lives of mostly the tenant farmers and the sharecroppers who were living in the South. And he tried to impact their lives in tangible, specific ways that would help them on a day-to-day basis.
Carver began urging farmers to rotate crops and to use organic fertilizers. He preached the value of planting soil-restoring crops such as peanuts, sweet potatoes, black-eyed peas, and soybeans.
He adapts it to the circumstance and develops a very different version of what scientific agriculture should be. One that emphasizes ecological thinking to a degree that very few, maybe no other progressive era endeavors did. In the late 1930s, he looks back over his career and says, my work is that of conservation. And what did he mean by that? What would change about the way we understand America's conservation tradition if we took him seriously, if we look at his work as a part of that broader American tradition of conservation?
He issued bulletins that uneducated farmers could understand, explaining how these soil-restoring crops should be grown and what they could be used for. He devised a traveling demonstration wagon called the Jessup Wagon and traveled dusty roads to teach small groups of farmers how to improve their lives. Start where you are with what you have, he would say. Make something of it. Never be satisfied.
He demonstrated in a prophetic manner two major current problems, the need for sustainability and conservation.
Everywhere Carver went, he had this innate ability to connect with people of all creeds, cultures, and colors. He had an effect on those he met as they had an effect on him. They learned from one another. The community of Tuskegee was no different.
He wanted to know everything about me, my background, my mother, my father, my sisters and brothers. And from that time, we got to be very good friends.
He liked Fatback. And my daddy would, that was his specialty. And his friend, Mr. Parker, Felton Parker, was a baker, but he also was a barber, and he used to cut Carver's hair. And so Mr. Parker and my dad were both proud of knowing Carver and being able to do a little something for him. They respected him. Oh, yes, and my dad was so proud that he took that back to Carver.
He had to have his dinner at 12 o'clock. If it was not there, he would not eat it. But one day, a mother came in pre-eclampsia. She was pregnant. Well, she didn't get his gun at 12 noon that day. Got it at 1 o'clock. I told him while I was late. I said, a mother came in pre-eclampsia. She was in a coma. And Dr. Mitchell called us to the operating room, and that's why your dinner is late. Well, I would not be in the world if it had not been for a female, my mother. She made your dinner.
She always said that Dr. Carver was such a gentle person, so kind, so caring. And I said, well, Mother, how do you figure that? So, well, he would stop, he would talk, he would take time.
Thousands of letters from the famous and unknown flooded Carver's modest office at the Tuskegee Institute.
People would write him about problems with their farms and their crops and almost anything. He seemed to be able to answer any question in the universe. He wrote more than 25,000 letters in his life. Well, he would receive all these letters, 6 or 8 or 10, and he would read them at night, go to sleep, and he believed that the problems were worked out while he was asleep in his subconscious. And it seemed to work because his letters are full of insightful answers.
When I visited Tuskegee University, I had the remarkable opportunity to stay in George Washington Carver's suite. And I realized, you know, how long he was there, half a century. And I think of how many he interacted with and influenced, and how many of those who were involved in the extension work all throughout the South as part of reaching out to all black farming families. When you think about all those years, all those people, I don't know if that gets highlighted to the extent that it should.
Most agree that Carver was a gifted teacher, whether in the classroom or in the field, who instilled a sense of wonder and curiosity in his students.
I interviewed a number of his former students. Admittedly, they were quite elderly, but they had a great admiration for him as a teacher. I don't think he was a conventional teacher who stood before class and lectured. One former student of his described him to me as being like Socrates. He said he would never tell you anything. He would force you to work for answers yourself. And I think that's why students found him so challenging and interesting. And there's abundant evidence that he spent enormous amount of time with students, and that even after students left, he maintained correspondence with them. And a lot of these letters, and I've read many of them, are addressed to him as Dear Daddy, Dear Father, Dear Dad. And he would often sign these letters as Your Father. He never married and never had children. I think his students were his surrogate children in that regard.
Just a simple individual, wasn't hard to talk to, just as kind and nice. He would take, you know, he would, you know, being a genius, you know, he would think he would kind of be a little standoff, a little selfish, not kind and not polite. He just acted like a real human being.
You must get an education, and you must do this, and you must do that. And he really affected my life greatly.
At administration and faculty politics, Carver was less adept. Booker T. Washington, perhaps the nation's most influential black man in the early years of the 20th century, was increasingly away from the campus. Carver found himself embroiled in bitter rivalries that eventually would cost him the chairmanship of the Agriculture Department.
Carver expected total deference. He didn't expect anybody to question his decisions or his actions. And so as a consequence of that, I think they clashed.
Carver quit Tuskegee several times. He sent his resignation. Never was accepted. But Carver believed in the work of Tuskegee to the point that when he died, he left his entire fortune to Tuskegee.
He stayed in large part because of his loyalty to his adopted region and its struggling farmers, and to the hundreds of earnest students, his children, who idolized him. As his tenure at Tuskegee approached two decades, George Washington Carver was well known and respected throughout the South and among agriculturalists in other areas of the country. Then, in late 1915, an event took place that put Carver on the path to international stardom. Booker T. Washington unexpectedly died.
They had a new president. Washington had only called himself the principal. He'd never said he was the president. But the new person, Robert Russo Mosen, called himself the president. He was very good. But things changed a lot for Carver as soon as Mosen took over. I mean, Carver was starting to want to withdraw into his laboratory a little bit more. And he pretty much told the new president that he was going to do that. He didn't really ask, and he went along with it. So suddenly Carver was able to control his own destiny.
Within a year, he had been elected to the board of the National Agricultural Society and became the first black man to be elected a fellow in Britain's Royal Society for the Encouragement of the Arts. Yet few of Carver's inventions ever found wide use, and only three ideas were patented, two for paint produced from clays and one for cosmetics, leading some to question Carver's scientific legacy.
He had an open mind of developing things, and he didn't care anything about money. The auditor was on him all the time with cashes, checks.
One way to look at Carver's work is just to think about him being the integrator of research and extension and coming up with the multiple uses of peanuts, ways of dealing with the boll weevil crop rotations, which some people may say that's not science because it's not basic, but it is real in terms of applying sciences that are going to serve society. There is a real role for applied research. It does not have to justify itself.
That's always been a puzzle to me, is that people have claimed that Carver wasn't a good scientist or wasn't a scientist because they never could find any of his works to prove it. Well, we have those works. They dispel any of that. They're replete with any numbers of calculations, observations. He uses the scientific method over and over again. That alone should settle the issue.
I think in everything he did, he said he was searching for the truth. That's what science is about. So I think he was true to himself, and he never wavered from what he really believed.
Carver came to prominence around 1920 for his work with peanuts, which eventually led to his creation of over 300 products from the plant.
He said that one time a woman came and said, "Well, Mr. Carver, I planted all these peanuts, and now what am I going to do with them?" And he said, I had a sort of stupid look on my face, and I said, "Well, I'll think about it." And he went back to his laboratory, and that's the famous story of when he sat out in the woods and said, "Mr. Creator," asked him what he should do. And the Creator said, "So what do you want?" And he said, "I want to know all about nature," something very broad. And the Creator said, "That's far too big a question for you, little man. You must narrow it down. Increase the intent and decrease the extent." And Carver said, "Well, how about knowing about the peanut?" And he said that the Creator said, "Well, that's a little bit more your size. But it's still infinite." Carver set to work and created hundreds of products out of the peanut. And this was a demonstration. This is to say, look what you can do.
His peanut work intrigued people, and so became the main feature of his public persona. Sometimes his message of planting soil-building crops got lost in all the attention he received on that one phase of his work. And there were other factors working against the world hearing his message.
It's ultimately the political economy of the South that causes Carver's campaign to fail. And this is because no matter how good his ideas were, and his ideas were very good, they were very ecologically sound, and they could make a difference. And I would argue that in some ways they did make a difference. So there are maybe 150 or black farmers who owned their own land in Macon County in 1896 when Carver shows up. There are more than 500 by World War I, which is basically when Carver's campaign, at least as a protracted effort, comes to a close. Now, that's not all due to Carver's work, but Carver's campaign contributed to this growth. But ultimately, the deeply entrenched racism of the Jim Crow South meant that Carver's plan had little hope of working in the long term.
Throughout the 1920s and 1930s, Carver gained ever-increasing fame. He was offered jobs by well-known individuals. The inventor, Thomas Edison, offered him a $100,000 salary to come work in his lab in New Jersey, but he turned it down to stay among his people. He befriended leaders from around the world. In 1937, Carver met business mogul Henry Ford in Dearborn, Michigan, at a meeting of pioneers in the Chemergy movement, a branch of applied chemistry that was concerned with preparing industrial products from agricultural raw materials. Over the next few years, Ford and Carver visited each other back and forth and remained in close contact.
Henry Ford picked Carver's brain at every opportunity he could get. Ford had a big plantation in Ways, Georgia. He actually built a school on the property and called it the George Washington Carver School. Had Carver come over and dedicate it. And whenever they met, they would walk around, and Ford would just keep feeding Carver questions one after the other to try to find out how to use certain crops.
The last time Henry Ford visited him, he was in Dorothy Hall, and he was living on the second floor, and it was difficult going up and down those stairs. Henry Ford called Montgomery to get an elevator company to come out, and he put an elevator in Dorothy Hall from the first floor to the second floor for Dr. Carver. Henry Ford thought a lot of Dr. Carver.
African Americans, Carver had become living proof of a black man who had overcome great difficulty and achieved greatness.
I have experienced a lot of discrimination that he experienced, and I admired him because of the obstacles with which he was confronted. And he did all this with grace, with determination, with courage, never bitterness. So he was a great model for me to try to exemplify.
He was trying to bring this whole group of people up from nothing.
To many Southern whites, Carver showed the brilliance and heart that wordlessly challenged the system of sharp segregation. To those working for racial harmony, he exemplified their ideal. Carver subscribed to Booker T. Washington's views, which held that blacks should attain an economic foothold before trying to tear down social and political barriers. They had their critics. African-American scholar W.E.B. Du Bois, the first black person to earn a Ph.D. from Harvard University, condemned what he described as their unwillingness to challenge white racism.
I think it is very complicated. Both men were born into slavery. Du Bois was not. And I think they simply tried to do the best they could with the understanding that they had at the time. Carver has been criticized for being an accommodationist. One historian, Lewis Harlan, in a book about Booker T, described Carver as, quote, hot bookering Booker. I think that's, you know, I think that's unfair to both men. I think that Carver struggled with this all of his life, and we're still struggling with it today.
I think Carver's, if you want to call it such, revolutionary disposition was creativity, was discovery, not activism in the socio-political context. Could he have done more in that regard? Yes, but I think he was made differently.
In 1938, when Carver was 74, he was diagnosed with pernicious anemia and was hospitalized for almost a year. As soon as he could, he returned to experiments in his laboratory, preparing his legacy in the Carver Museum at Tuskegee and establishing the George Washington Carver Foundation to carry on his work with needy fathers. George Washington Carver died January 5, 1943, at around age 78, and is buried on the Tuskegee campus near Booker T. Washington. He could have added fortune to fame, his epitaph reads, but caring for neither, he found happiness and honor in being helpful to the world.
I was in the desert in North Africa, and it was all more the distinguished announcer of broadcasting from London. He said, Dr. George Washington Carver, the distinguished scientist in America, died today. It was sad. It was very sad news to me. And so that was the last of Dr. Carver.
75 years after his death, the world still looks to Carver for inspiration. Students continue to report on his life, and thousands of people still visit the places that honor him. His is a legacy that defies time.
In 1941, he opened all of his artwork to the public. He put on a big exhibition, and there had been nothing up to that time. All of his works from Simpson College and a few since then. And people were stunned at the fact that this great agricultural expert, chemist, botanist, et cetera, was also an artist. A good friend of his who was working, writing articles, she asked him that question, Bess Walcott. She said, how have you been able to do many things? And he said, would it surprise you if I told you I have only been doing one thing? And he said Tennyson, Alfred Lord Tennyson, the English poet, was working at the same job, and he picked up a little plant, tiny plant in his hand with the roots still on it and soil clinging to the roots. And he quoted Tennyson, flower in the crannied wall, I pluck you out of the crannies. I hold you here, root and all, in my hand. Little flower, but if I could understand what you are, root and all in all, I should know what God and man is. And this really was the core of Carver's thinking. He said Tennyson was seeking truth. That's what the artist is seeking, that's what the scientist is seeking, and that's what I've been doing all my life.
Wow, that was a very wonderful presentation on George Washington Carver, which I've never heard before. While George Washington Carver rose up from slavery to scientific accomplishments, has inspired millions, time has reduced him to the man who did something only with the peanut. And this documentary uncovers Carver's complexities and reveals the full impact of his life and work. And I don't know whether that professor is still alive or not up in Connecticut, who spent most of his time teaching at either Wesleyan or doing scientific experiments on the water. And I don't know if he listens to my show, but I wish that, I hope he, if he is alive, because I think he was around the same age as I am, and so there's a good possibility that he's still alive. I'm not going to mention his name. If he is listening, he will know what I'm talking about. It's too bad that he has spent a life working science and did not know about the great George Washington Carver, Dr. George Washington Carver. We're going to go on and do something about what's called the Masters of Inventions full length. And that way that we will be ending our show at the conclusion of this one. But let's see what this one's all about.
Hello, I'm Glenn Turner. African Americans have long been acknowledged for their creativity and genius in theater, dance, music, art, and literature. But there's another kind of creative contribution African Americans have made, and that's the art of invention. From the moment you turn a doorknob, flick an on-off switch, start your engine, stop for a traffic light, take an elevator, watch a missile launch, or talk on your cellular phone, you've come into contact with an invention or innovation created by an African American. Since records of inventors' race weren't kept when the U.S. Patent Office was established in 1790, we may never know exactly how many patents were issued to African Americans. Now, probably the person most responsible for gathering information on early black inventors was Henry E. Baker. An assistant U.S. patent officer and graduate of Harvard Law School, Baker dedicated his life to uncovering and publicizing the contributions of black inventors.
Under the auspices of the U.S. Patent Office, Baker sent out letters to lawyers throughout the country asking them to identify any black inventors they may have filed patent papers for. In 1913, patent lawyer B.J. Nolan of Chattanooga, Tennessee, wrote, "I never knew a Negro to even suggest an idea, much less try to patent one. And I've dealt with them Negroes all my life." Baker didn't let letters like that discourage him. By the time of his death, his work produced 4 massive volumes and uncovered some remarkable inventions patented by black men and women. In 18th century America, one black man of inventive genius made a name for himself. A tobacco farmer named Benjamin Banneker. He resembled Benjamin Franklin in stature and was one of the country's most brilliant mathematicians. Inspired by the theories of Copernicus, Banneker became a self-taught astronomer at age 60. In 1754, at the age of 24, Banneker made a clock entirely out of wood, which remained accurate for nearly 40 years. He was one of the surveyors in the planning of Washington, D.C., and a scientific genius. With borrowed books and instruments, Banneker taught himself the fundamentals of astronomy, keeping a journal of his calculations. Besides predicting the weather and seasons, Banneker used his almanac to extol the achievements of blacks beyond himself. When he included a poem written by the renowned poet Phyllis Wheatley, he wrote, "Africans and their descendants are capable of attaining a degree of eminence in the liberal sciences. Benjamin is not the only proof." Wheatley's poem perhaps best echoed their feelings about the injustices of human bondage.
"Should you wonder from whence my love of freedom sprung? I young and lied by a seeming cruel fate, was snatched from Africa, fancy happy seat. What pains excruciating must molest, what sorrow labor in my parents' breast. Steeled was that, should and by no misery moved, that from a father sees this babe beloved. Such my case. And can I then but pray others may never feel tyrannic sway."
Just as Banneker loved the stars, James Fortin of Philadelphia loved the sea. One of the original abolitionist leaders, Fortin invented a device around 1800 that aided in the control of sails on ships. He amassed a fortune, built his own sail factory, and worked on the Underground Railroad helping slaves to escape. There's an African proverb that says, as the wound inflames the finger, so thought inflames the mind. And despite their circumstances, slaves created a number of inventions before the Civil War. Until they were considered citizens, however, African-American inventors were ignored, prohibited from securing patents, or slave owners took credit for their discoveries. Such was almost the case of Benjamin Montgomery of Virginia, who invented a propeller specifically designed for river steamboats. Montgomery was owned by Joseph Davis, brother of Jefferson Davis, the future president of the Confederacy. Now, when the brothers tried to patent Montgomery's propeller, Attorney General Jeremiah S. Black enacted a decision in 1858 that prohibited owners from doing so. So as a result, any slave invention during the next 12 years went undocumented. Before the Civil War, a free black man named Norbert Rillot from New Orleans revolutionized the sugar industry in a bittersweet story. Born on a plantation and educated as an engineer in Paris, Rillot gave the world its biggest economic sugar fix. Making sugar by the slow, dangerous kettle method inspired Rillot to find a better way. And on August 26, 1843, he received his first patent for his sugar refining process, or the multiple effect vacuum evaporator, which turns sugar juice into a fine grade of white sugar crystals. Rillot became a wealthy and influential man in New Orleans, but was still subjected to oppressive race laws. When he was told he'd have to carry a pass to move about the city, Rillot decided to leave America forever and return to France. France's gain was surely America's loss. Industrial growth in America was tremendous, and both black and white inventors were responsible. By 1870, the patent restraints for blacks had been lifted and signaled an explosion of inventions to come. One of those inventions was from Jan Metzeliger, a black immigrant from New Guinea who settled in Lynn, Massachusetts, the center of the shoemaking industry. His invention revolutionized the shoe manufacturing industry and created thousands of jobs. Prior to Metzeliger's invention, connecting the leather uppers to the soles of the shoes was done by hand, a process called lasting. He wanted to make shoes affordable for everyone, and after working secretly at night for 10 years, Metzeliger created a lasting machine that could turn out a complete shoe. His drawings, however, were so complex, the U.S. Patent Office couldn't believe the machine worked, so an official was sent to inspect it. And on March 20th, 1883, Jan Metzeliger was issued his first patent. Metzeliger tried unsuccessfully to market his invention himself and sold the rights to his invention for stock in a new company. He took to performing in plays, but died a forgotten inventor before he reaped any financial rewards. Metzeliger's recognition finally came a century later, when a postage stamp commemorated his name and a bridge in his honor was dedicated in his hometown of Lynn, Massachusetts. With the introduction of Henry Ford's Model T, cars began to move horses aside, and America shifted full speed ahead. Between 1871 and 1900, more than 300 patents were awarded for inventions and innovations by blacks. Inventors have become a part of American folklore as well. If you've ever heard the phrase, the real McCoy, you know what I mean. The phrase was coined for a master inventor, Elijah McCoy, who ultimately patented over 60 lubricating systems, including an air brake system for railroads. In the late 1870s, most machines, including trains, had to be stopped every time they needed oil. The oilman would
walked the length of the train and oiled all the moving parts. McCoy devised a method for oiling machinery as it was running. And on June 23, 1872, he received a patent for the lubricating cup. McCoy believed in producing quality work. As a result, his lubricating system was used on locomotives, machinery in factories, and on engines of transatlantic steamships around the world. McCoy's system was so effective that buyers of new machinery would ask the sellers, does the equipment have the real McCoy? If it didn't, they wouldn't buy it. So if you want the genuine article, the real thing, just ask for the real McCoy. In a country that still had the feeling that the oppressed race had contributed little or nothing, African Americans began to catch the public's attention. Exhibits at the 1895 Atlanta Exposition and the 1907 Jamestown Exposition gave black inventors the opportunity to showcase their accomplishments. On the flip side, in 1896, the Supreme Court ruled in Plessy versus Ferguson that separate but equal facilities for whites and blacks was constitutional, which marked the beginning of Jim Crow laws and legalized segregation. Despite the trials and stresses of life, people enjoyed their recreational time, and hobbies were springboards for inventions. Now take, for instance, dentist George Grant. He loved playing golf. And on December 12, 1899, he received a patent for an object that golfers have been using ever since. The golf tee. Before Grant's inventions, players would form cone-shaped mounds of sand with their fingers on which the ball sat. Now today, this tooth-shaped invention has improved many a golfer's drive. Just as today's technological revolution celebrates the super information highway, the second half of the 19th century centered around its new age power, electricity. In every school book, the name of Thomas Edison and Alexander Bell are imprinted in our minds, but recognition for their distinguished African-American colleagues, Granville T. Woods and Lewis Latimer, is long overdue. Lewis Latimer was a self-made man who became a pioneer in the development of electricity. He drafted the original plans for Alexander Bell's telephone and made significant contributions to the success of both Thomas Edison and Hiram Maxim, Edison's competitor. While employed with Maxim, Latimer perfected Edison's light bulb by making improvements in the incandescent electric lamp in 1882. He then supervised the installation of electric lighting systems in major cities around the world. Known as the Black Edison, Granville T. Woods was an electromechanical genius. Like Edison, Woods was years ahead of his time and founded his own company to research, manufacture, and market his electrical inventions. His versatility resulted in 65 patents relating to electricity, from electric railway cars to an incubator for hatching chicken eggs. When the first subway rail pulled into Grand Central Station, Granville Woods had made his mark. In 1901, he was issued a patent for the third rail system, still used in subways today around the world. Concerned about the number of train collisions, Woods developed a railway telegraphy system, which improved train safety by letting the train engineer know how close his train was to others. And in 1899, he received a patent for an amusement apparatus. Woods' two-track ride, originally invented for indoors and outdoors, evolved into what we now know as the roller coaster. Woods' inventions caught the public's attention when he won two legal disputes against Edison. In fact, when Edison lost the second action, he asked Woods to come work for him. But Woods, whose patents were bought by General Electric, Bell Telephone, and Westinghouse decided to remain on his own.
By the turn of the century, a surge of inventions was well underway. African Americans received an estimated 1,000 patents by 1913 in nearly every field of industrial arts, machinery, transportation, agricultural, and electrical devices.
Gerald Morgan was constantly thinking about the future. He'd say, if it's in a book, you can do it. If it's not, then use your imagination. And despite having only a sixth grade education, Morgan's inventions, the traffic signal and the gas mask, became two of the world's most significant safety-related devices.
On July 25th, 1960, an explosion rocked the mining site. Three rescue teams died attempting to save the miners. But Garrett Morgan, wearing an invention he called a breathing apparatus, entered the toxic mine and pulled the surviving men to safety. Morgan's invention came to rescue again during World War I, when British and U.S. troops needed gas masks to fend off Germans' newest weapon, poison gas. Back in the States, city traffic was hazardous. Morgan witnessed a terrible accident and developed the first illuminated traffic signal, which alerted drivers to proceed with caution. Garrett Morgan received his patent on November 20, 1923, which he later sold to the General Electric Company for $40,000. His system was used until it was replaced with the automatic electric traffic lights we have today.
Like inventors, African-American scientists have made phenomenal contributions as well. Grammy-winning composer Stevie Wonder even wrote a song about one of them, Dr. George Washington Carver. Best known for his work with the peanut and his 300 or more derivative products, which include instant coffee, bleach, tan remover, metal polish, paper, ink, shaving cream, rubbing oil, linoleum, paint, and plastic. Carver was a man on a mission.
A scientific genius, Carver felt a deep affinity for farmers and convinced them to grow diversified crops such as peanuts, pecan, and sweet potatoes in place of one crop, cotton, to re-nourish their soils. A deeply spiritual man, Carver also obtained fame as an artist. His varied interests led to his close friendship with Henry Ford, who shared his fascination with synthetic rubber. Carver's research as an agricultural chemist won him international acclaim. When Carver died in 1943 in Alabama, the governor and crowds of people came to honor him. The U.S. Postal Service issued a memorial stamp for the man who was dubbed the Savior of the South.
Madam C.J. Walker became a millionaire as a result of her hair care products. But although she didn't patent any of her products, she was a pioneer entrepreneur and an inspiration to women around the world.
In 1885, Sarah Good received her patent for a folding bed, a forerunner of today's sofa bed. Sarah Broom was issued a patent in 1892 for her improvement to the ironing board. Alice H. Parker wanted to warm each room in her building with centralized heating and received a patent for her improvement on the heating furnace in 1919. And Harriet Bradbury patented her torpedo discharger for submarines in 1943.
Ellen Elgin, who patented a financially successful clothes wringer in the 1880s, sold her device to an agent for $18. Elgin's feelings mirrored a long-standing practice of black inventors, both men and women, who chose to sell their inventions to whites or white-controlled corporations for fear of their inventions losing value if their true identities were known. The contributions inventors and scientists have made is tremendous. As we look to the future, there are two African Americans who are continuing that creativity. Take the case of ophthalmologist Dr. Patricia Bass, who in 1988 received a patent for the laser phaco probe. Now, that's a device that removes cataracts. Dr. Bath holds the patents for her inventions in Japan, Canada, Europe, and the United States.
I was once referred a very difficult and challenging case of a blind woman.
I spent many nights thinking and planning her surgery. And then, by divine inspiration, an idea occurred of a new way to remove cataracts using a fiber-guided laser. I realized that this technique was a great improvement in cataract surgery. I then conducted some research studies in Berlin, and it was at that point that I developed my first of many prototypes of the laser phaco probe. As a black woman surgeon, it's very difficult to overcome some of the stereotypic impressions of male colleagues. When I joined the faculty of UCLA in 1974, I was the first woman faculty member in the Department of Ophthalmology. I imagine my colleagues did not feel that I could be equally gifted and skilled. However, I now accept the challenge because it made me struggle to be the very best.
Engineer Lonnie Johnson strikes a chord of success in two very different worlds with his invention.
I've been an inventor all my life. As long as I can remember, I have been tinkering and making things work. So I decided to do away with something simple that most people could appreciate and use the revenues from that invention as a stepping stone to allow me to do some of my more challenging ideas. The role of the inventor is like a barnstormer, the guy who comes in and shakes everything up and is able to take on the big boys.
From telephones to electric street lighting, from refrigerated trucks to automatic transmissions, and from artificial heart stimulators to space shuttle retrieval arms, African-American inventors have triumphed over adverse conditions and continue to contribute to scientific and innovative discoveries that benefit the global community. We've met just a few of the men and women who are making it happen. We hope that you will visit your local library and continue the journey.
Well, there you had it. It's very difficult to even discuss. When I was teaching at Springfield College, I taught a course in Black history. And I knew most of these particular people. I'd read about them. I didn't know them personally, but I had known about some of their accomplishments, and it was very difficult when you have a class that is predominantly white to get them to appreciate some of the contributions that black people have made as inventions that have really made life a little easier to live and function. Making it happen, Masters of Invention, it's an executive producer, James Graves, was the one who actually put his foot in and said, okay, let's do something to give people an opportunity to see exactly what African-American people are really able to and have been able to do. And because the cotton gin, for example, a lot of people don't, they say, okay, Eli Whitney did that, but actually it was a black person who was a slave. That was not mentioned in this presentation, but I've read many accounts of Eli Whitney's not actually knowing how the whole thing actually worked when he was trying to give a presentation to farmers about how the whole thing was supposed to happen. In any event, this has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. And little as it's known, I would love to continue with it. We have about 6 minutes left in the show. However, it's not going to be possible for me to find anything, or I haven't researched something that would allow for just a short period of 6 minutes. But I can say this to you. Ralph up in Connecticut, I hope you had an opportunity to hear about the great scientist George Washington Carver. Not only was he a scientist, he also was an inventor. But also all of the various inventions, even to the point where the suit that space people use, the astronauts use that were walking out in space, was invented by a black person at Pratt & Whitney in East Hartford, Connecticut. So I'm not going to keep this going on and on because there are a lot of other things that I'd like to tell you about, because next time we'll get together and I will tell you something else about what you probably don't know anything about, or if you do, you're like me, wanting to know more. So have a fantastic weekend, and on Monday, God willing, I will be back to give another presentation. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Have a good evening.